How can historians help to prevent conflicts?
Well, I would start out by stopping the abuse and misuse of history to keep up conflicts and to prevent their resolution. We have so many examples from history, but also in today's world, how history continues to be used for negative purposes, keeping up enemy images and so on. Sometimes historians themselves are party to this, but mostly it's because their work can be misused by others for negative purposes. So we started asking ourselves in Finland, what could historians do to turn this the other way around? How could historians contribute to conflict prevention and conflict resolution by putting their knowledge, expertise at the service of mediation efforts, and so on? And this was the background for establishing the International Network of Historians Without Borders.
You said there are many examples. I was remembering about the case of former Yugoslavia, where the intellectuals and historians had a significant role in the I won't say directly in the collapse of the country, but they somehow contributed to the unfold of the events.
Very much so, and indeed, President Martti Ahtisaari, our Nobel Peace Prize laureate, who was also at the present at the meeting where we founded this organization and at our conference, recalled how he, as mediator, when he began in the Western Balkans, he was first treated to a hours-long lecture on 14th century history, and it would have gone on for much longer had he not stopped it. But it gave him a good recognition of how history is being used in these conflicts. Last year was the centenary of the 1915 events in Turkey, where up to 1.5 million Armenians lost their lives. Historians on both sides are now more or less in agreement on what actually happened, the facts and perhaps even the interpretation. But it's still a source of conflict, whether to call it a genocide or not.
Is there a way to overcome these conflict narratives?
Well, the first thing is to get historians from all sides to sit at the same table and listen to each other's narratives. You don't have to accept it, you can contest it, but you have to know it before you can enter into any real kind of discussion. Now, this we are trying to promote also in very concrete situations. And then also in mediation, there may be instances where historians could be called on to act as members of commissions or as experts in helping address these historical issues. But also after a peace agreement has been signed, I think that it's still important to continue addressing the historical issues, because if you think you have left them behind and buried them, they may return to haunt you unless they have been properly opened and addressed.
In most of the situations, do you think that historians are aware of the manipulation they may be being submitted to, or are they not conscious of that?
Well, sometimes I think that they even may be a party to it, but that's a minority among historians. I think we should also raise awareness of historians to be more actively opposed to their work being misused for this kind of enemy image and other building purposes.
And once conflict happens, is there any role historians can play in conflict resolution?
I think there is, because when you have a peace agreement, some of the legal issues have to be dealt with, but not the historical ones. But the historical ones, if they are not opened and addressed, they may return and at worst lead to a renewal of the conflict. So I think it is part and partial of any peace process, which has to also build confidence and mutual understanding among the parties. It's not enough to keep them separate and stop them from immediately killing each other. That is the first step, but that's not enough to guarantee peace.
Above all, would you say that there is a huge lack of historical knowledge, and that is why you created the Historians Without Borders, and it was made public, the Helsinki Declaration.
Unfortunately, there is a growing lack of historical knowledge. I would say that we are living in ahistorical times, meaning that people are less and less aware of how and from where we have come to where we are today. And that means that they cannot see into the future either, and that they are more prone to those machinations who want to use or misuse history for their own purposes. So if you don't know history, then you can be easily a prisoner of history and historical myth.
As an experienced politician working in the Foreign Affairs Ministry in Finland, how would you look at the current foreign policy from Russia?
Well, that has been an item which we have discussed for many years among European ministers. For example, what are Russians' intentions? Some people think that there is a wish to re-establish the Soviet Union or even the borders of the Russian Empire. I don't believe this. I think, yes, there are people, even close to the leadership, who have these kind of thoughts. But they are more, it's more wishful thinking than any kind of concrete plan. At the end of the day, I think that the Russians will use or have used open doors to go through if there is an opportunity to further what they think as their interest. But if these doors are not kept open and if they are made aware of the risks involved and the consequences thereof, I think they will be much more careful not to do it. So I'm not in that sense worried about Russia's intention, because at the end of the day, the Russian people want exactly the same kind of things that people all over the world. They want security, they want a better life for themselves and their children, and the use of force in today's world will not bring any of these kind of benefits. Even in history, there have been longer periods where you could argue that you could enhance your own national interest at the cost of others. But in today's world, which is growing in interdependence, this is no longer possible. But some people are still wedded to these old forms of thinking in many military circles, but also in another political circle. So we have to be able to deal with this kind of thinking. But I think that the most important lesson which the Russians are now learning is that the policy that they have now used for the past few years has not brought any benefits. It has brought the Russian economy, if not to collapse, at least has inflicted serious damage, and not primarily because of the sanctions. They have played a role, but mostly because people, even the Russian people and those who have money, do not have confidence in a government or in a policy which is based on the use of military force.
Finland is in a sensitive position, let's say, and from time to time there comes a discussion about Finnish membership to NATO.
Well, Finnish public opinion is very stable on the subject. It has been for the past 25 years, on average, 60% against, 25% for. So it's not on the table today. And we do not feel militarily threatened by Russia. We are concerned about Russian behavior, but we do not see that Finland is any cause for them. From the Russian point of view, the Finnish frontier, 1,300 kilometers, is the only one where they have no problems. They have problems everywhere else. Many of them have been created by themselves, but nevertheless, I don't expect that they would want to create more problems on this border to add to those they already have.
It concerns you more, the current situation in Europe and the Eurozone?
Well, even in the Baltic Sea region, where we have seen a growth in tensions and military activities, exercises and shows of force, I don't think that there are such issues in the Baltic region which would entail anybody trying to solve them through military means. But conflicts elsewhere, in the Ukraine and Crimea, they are reflected also into the Baltic region. and nobody is isolated from that.
How much concerned are you about the current situation of Europe and the European Union?
Well, the paradox is that today there would be a huge demand for European leadership, given the situation with Russia, but also given the situation with the United States, where after Trump's election we are facing even more uncertainty about what they are going to do than we have with Russia. So there would be a need, there is clearly a need for European leadership. Unfortunately, there is a clear lack of leadership. We have seen this center, this disruptive tendencies. We have Brexit, which I believe does not necessarily have to be final, because 2 years, 2.5 years, which the process will take, will give ample time for the Brits to reconsider. And I believe that...
Especially in a parliamentary system.
Yes, I believe that if the Brits were asked today, was this a good idea, the majority would say no. So we have to keep the door open for that. Brexit, yes. If they want it, yes, they have the right to it. But do not make it impossible for them to reconsider. That is to everyone's advantage in Europe. And we need to look more at how to strengthen European common foreign and security policy. We also need, and I think that this is slowly being understood, that with the refugee crisis and asylum seekers, we need common migration policies and common principles on how to deal with asylum. To protect the free movement of people, which is one of the best achievements of European integration, but also to see to it that we can also in the future gain from what we have achieved. I know there are some countries who still say no, no, no to anything to be done on the European level, but I think that this is already changing, because nobody can handle these issues on their own.
And the impact that the refugee crisis has been playing in different countries has been somehow fostering the populisms all over.
Well, I think it has been the sort of last straw which has enhanced this populism. But we have seen this populism and this growing Euroscepticism already before the present crisis, because of the Euro crisis, because I think also because people have been fed up with the very elitist way in which European integration has been done. On the basis of people who think that they know better than others what is good for all of us in Europe, and who are willing to impose their views on others without the necessary democratic approval, thinking that they can gain this afterward. But I think that this has come to an end. This is very much a crisis of legitimacy, of democratic legitimacy in Europe that we are facing. So in some respects we need perhaps to take a few steps backward. We do not need to regulate everything from Brussels or so much as we are doing today, but we also clearly need more common European policies in face of these immigration issues, in face of the world situation. And actually, the rest of the world is looking to Europe for European leadership, because Europe is more easily trusted because it's not a superpower and it doesn't have its own military might than any other international actor.
Europe as a whole? European Union?
Yes. And the European Union, when it has got its act together, has had a positive role. I would say without the European Union's input, we wouldn't have the Paris Treaty, and we wouldn't have any action on climate change to the extent we have today. We wouldn't have the International Criminal Court without the European Union. All other powers were opposed to it, but it was the European Union who stuck to the principle and made it possible.
But do you think that is it possible to EU countries to stick together when some of them, and I'm thinking about Hungary or Poland, at least, are in some way putting in question some common values about the European project?
That's a very important question, because the European Union has to have credibility in sticking to its values. And if we have countries who are directly confronting these values and acting against them, then there has to be consequences. And I think that the European Commission has taken the first steps. But unless these countries correct some of their policies, then they have to have consequences, the first being, of course, the loss of voting rights in the Council, and or also loss of European subsidies.
You mentioned the unpredictability of Donald Trump, but can we somehow project what his administration could be?
Well, we can, but there are so many.
There are some names already, so.
Well, there are so many conflicting projects, and even if you look at the names of the cabinet ministers around Trump now, they go in very different directions. So I think that, unfortunately, this uncertainty will continue for a long time, and we have to be sort of prepared for anything and everything.
When you look to the future, what do you think that historians will write, will publish about these times we are living now?
Well, I don't think we will have to wait too long for that, because the most pressing issue facing humanity today is unsustainable development, climate change being only one part of it, but perhaps the most dramatic part of it. So we have, at best, only a few decades time into which to bring all human activities in line with the demands of ecological, economic and social sustainability. What we are having in today's world is unsustainable, and I would particularly also point to the social instability, the social unsustainability. If you have a situation where 62 individuals own more than half of the whole world's population, 3.7 billion people, that is unsustainable. And I think this is part of the, or a very clear reason for the reaction of the American electorate and others against today's globalization. Globalization has brought huge benefits, but these benefits have been distributed increasingly unequally.